your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. To Australia.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
Hey, everybody. I'm Phil Lairness, and down under, that's Dean Haglund. How are you, Dean?
Hey, I'm down under, all right. But wide awake. It's Labor Day here, where we celebrate the day laboring by not laboring.
Well, we're going to start with a couple of live events of the week. Should we start with the conclusion of Hilarium?
Why not, I say?
Well, that would be you talking. I didn't go. So
I was waiting for Garrett Watley to have a little musical.
I already played it. Garrett Watley he came in at the end of the opening theme to announce the live events of the week.
Look at him. That's how clever he is.
Take two.
Yes, the Hilarium had its closing night on September 30th to a packed, and I mean packed house. We were on the fourth level of the old Rum Building in Chippendale, and we had to scour three levels of restaurants to find extra seating just to fill up the fourth level. So it was hilarious. People loved it. It was a marathon of excruciatingly long hours. But all in all, big success.
I have two questions. I'll ask my question first, then I'll ask undoubtedly the question. No, let's lead with the question undoubtedly burning a hole in the minds of our listeners. How do you have your mic set up that we can hear the drinking of water by Akasha more clearly than we can hear you? How exactly is that possible?
You know, maybe I should put the microphone by the water bowl. That is literally, what would that be, 25 feet away? I don't understand that.
Next time I see you, I have a really good wireless mic that I could give you for these, and you can tape them to yourself. Yeah. So anyway, your final performance, how many times did you perform during the month at the Hilarium?
Wow. You know, I lost count, actually. I would do, there were so many. I would be emceeing one show, doing a spotted set list, maybe Best of the Fest. The roast battle we had where we comic stick turned slamming each other. That was fun. And then, of course, Oz Comic Con happened, and Canadian improviser and voice of Commander Shepard, Mark Mears, popped in for a little improv set with myself and the head of Melbourne Theatre Sports, Patty Styles. So that was a really fun night. So all in all, I would say 15 times.
Wow.
That's my own show.
Wow. Yeah. And your final one was when?
That was the 30th, which
You closed out the month at the Hilarium with your one-man show, right?
The night before was my one-man show, closing it out. The final night was all the comics who had been there the entire month, coming in to celebrate and to give a send-off to hey-ho the Hilarium.
And we're going to get, and when I mean we, I mean the loyal legion of listeners to Chilpack Nation. We are going to get treated at some point in the coming weeks to some selections from the Hilarium, are we not?
Well, I did record some stuff, but it was on the iPhone, and it was in the middle of the room. So there's a lot of laughter that's drowning the comics out. So yes, we're going to give it a shot. I'm going to find some audio. If the phone audio that I recorded is crappy, because there was a lovely four track there recording some other shows. So I will, yes, this is how I would endeavor the week away to get those audio recordings.
Okay. Well, that'll be fun. And we can hopefully cut it into part of a show, maybe towards the end of the month. And by the way, happy October, everyone.
Yeah. Happy October.
I was on a bit of a trip last week, and I came back into town on Friday night, the 29th. Got in on a late night train into to Glendale, and what did I do? I got off the train because, as you know, Phil Larenas always travels with at least a sport coat, and I got into immediate. I kind of walked through the world in cocktail attire, but I got into cocktail attire, went straight to downtown LA to a very hidden little place called the Civic Center Studios. It's a couple flights up from a speakeasy. It's a very small performance venue. You wind your way up through candlelit staircases. And I saw an immersion into a magician's mind, a show called Seesaw, presented by Seesaw. Atlas Obscura, produced by one of the bigwigs at Atlas Obscura and a good breakfast clubber, a good ham and egger, Aaron Johnson, co-produced with the star of the show, Ecuadorian magician Siegfried Tiber. And this guy, first of all, I mean, he is such a character. If people don't know him, they can look up the video of Penn and Teller. I'm sure they can find videos of Siegfried Tiber, excuse me. But if you look up videos of that Penn and Teller show Fool Us, right? Penn and Teller's reality show Fool Us, where they bring on magicians who attempt to fool them, he's one of the only ones that has. And he specializes in close-up magic, and it was a fascinating show. It's 20 of us seated around him at a table. So he does tricks, but equally as much of the show is conversation with him. We ask him questions. He talks to us. He asks us questions. So we're it's basically a cocktail party. There's a bar in the room, so we're seated around him at the most polite cocktail party imaginable. But what you really, a keen observer, begins to realize is that all the questions that we think we're authoring and that we're asking and his answers to them are all part of how he is directing our attention throughout the evening. Because really, the major technique in magic is not, as people think, that sleight of hand is the art of misdirection. No, it's the art of direction, not misdirection.
Right.
It's the art of direction. And so many tricks where you think you have free will to pick a card or off the top of your head to pick a number or a color or what have you, you don't have free will. It's been planted in there. The suggestion has been planted. This is how mesmerists work, how psychics work, right?
Right. The amazing Kreskin.
Yeah. So it was fantastic to be up close with him. But what a performer he is also. You would love him, Dean, because his persona, the persona that he has developed is, it has this wonderful combination of feeling, I mean, it's wonderfully delightful, and it has the benefit of also feeling authentic. Now, does that mean all of it's authentic? Probably not. But as we know, as performers, you better than I, to feel authentic means to use technique, to use artifice sometimes, because you have to create the illusion of authenticity, because after all, it's an artificial setting. And this is the art of theater. This is the art of performance, right? But he's wonderful. He's about 29, 30 years old. He took up magic very late for magicians, because magicians usually take these things up very early as amateurs, right?
Childhood.
Yeah, he doesn't become interested until 19. That's when he starts to spend 2 years working on his first trick. It takes him 2 years before he's comfortable enough to perform that trick just for family. And the reaction he got was sufficient to say, maybe I should keep exploring this. So here he is 10 years after starting to perfect his first trick. He's fooling Penn and Teller, his heroes. But it's great because...
And I guess is Siegfried Tiber his real name?
Yes.
Like, how did
yes.
he not go into magic?
Exactly. Exactly. So, but the Siegfried is not for Siegfried and Roy. It's Siegfried because his father is from Vienna, hence the name, right? Siegfried.
Hence the name.
His mother is from Colombia, hence the crazy afro. And he was raised in Ecuador, hence his accent, as he says. So anyway, wow. Siegfried, it's going on for a few weeks here in L.A., but people should really look this up. Siegfried Tiber, and close-up magic is so exciting, especially when you are able to be immersed into his mind, because like I said, an immersion into the magician's mind means you've opened your mind to him completely.
Right.
And by the way, the technique parts of it, do I know how some of the tricks were done? Yes, I do.
You do.
Because as a director, I sit kind of on the outside. I refuse. Let me tell you this. But here's a trick that's played on me. To finish my thought before, but I never knew how a trick was done because of, maybe with one exception at one point, but never because his technique was in any way other than perfect. I never saw anything that let me know how it was done. I observed the entire evening and therefore know how certain things were done. Does that make sense?
Right. No.
Well, I'll explain the trick that was done to me, the beautiful trick of there's a guest list of who people are, okay. right? Mm-hmm. And you need to get on this guest list. The tickets are like $75. You need to get on the guest list. You have to go through several, you know, different checkpoints to be able to get into this building and this spot. So we're in the parking lot beforehand, quite a bit, maybe 15 minutes beforehand, which doesn't seem like a lot. But in L.A., 15 minutes before a door opens is really getting there early.
that's so a lifetime.
So there's no one else waiting, and we're sitting there, and I'm talking about how exhausted I am from the trip, a little bit in the complaint, right. like, why am I doing this to see magic? And I say how very much I will be upset if I get called on, if I have to participate. And I'm talking about this.
Yeah.
So 20 of us in that room at that event, not counting bar staff and, you know, the staff, but one person out of that 20 did not get called on in any way, did not get asked a question, did not be asked to participate. One person was left out entirely from all participation. And that was yours truly.
Wow. So he was already in tune with your negative attitude towards a participatory show.
So there's these two women who work, and it was really an interesting trick. Like, you're greeted by the person who checks you in outside, and then you're greeted by someone upstairs who checks you in. And it's the same person. You've left that person, and you come back up to her, and you go, wait a minute, that was the gal downstairs who just signed us in, and she's signing us in and giving us our programs again. Because, in fact, they hired intentionally identical twins who dressed identically. So trick number one, right? But then, you know, Lily and I were going, it's amazing. Like, you didn't want to be, you manifested it, Phil. You didn't want to be called on, and you weren't called on. And then we both looked at each other, and we said, but I was talking about that outside, right? And Lily said, yeah. So the woman who was going to sign us in would hear that. Because an interesting thing happened when we got to the top of the stairs and our programs were given to us. She kind of slipped and threw the program at me.
That.
He saw that.
What?
He saw that.
Yeah.
So I was marked as someone he shouldn't mess with.
Oh.
And and then he came up because he was hosting it too, not just the entertainment. Like, he greeted everyone into the cocktail portion. The first half hour was a get to know you mingling thing,
right?
And he came up and he would talk, and Lily was the only one who would speak, and he kept touching me, and I would react in a way that was clear that I wasn't really game for interaction. So he tested
Don't touch me.
He tested me too, and I would watch, and he wasn't really touchy with anyone else. But he was clearly trying to see, like, what my I think, what my vibe would be or whatever. I wasn't rude. I wasn't rude. I wasn't unhappy about being there. I was very interested in the show, very eager. But, you know, the reason why, and people ask me, why don't you want to be a part of this or whatever, is because once you get... And here was, you came up in the conversation that Lily and I were having because I was asking myself, how do I hold myself to make it clear I don't want to be a part of this? Because what I know from you is if I hold myself that way, you would call on me.
Right.
Because I would be the reticent one.
Right, exactly.
And since this
and then clearly that's the one.
And since this is comedy and magic, so am I going to make the same mistake? Am I going to be, called on because I don't want to be called on? But but indeed I wasn't, as per my wishes. And the reason they were my wishes, like I said, was because I want to be able to observe the whole thing. I don't want my observation, my focus, I don't want it diminished by being inside it.
Right.
You know, I don't want to have my point of view as audience deflected. So anyway, that was a great...
Well, you want to use your director's eye to see the show.
Yeah. I wanted to have the experience of an audience. I don't really like being a participant in these things. I don't go to shows wanting to be a participant.
Yes. So. Yes, very few people do go to shows wanting to be a participant.
Do you think so? You've put on a lot of shows. I get the feeling people go deep down wanting to be a participant.
Well, they like, you know, it's varying degrees, right? In any improv show, getting to the chance to yell your head off at the guy on stage, that's fun participation. But being dragged up, I say 50-50 tolerate it for sure. And then the actual volunteer and come up on stage, that's in the 10 to 20%.
So I would love to talk about this the whole time, but we have news to get to. We've got movies. We've got celebrity death. So I guess we move on.
Absolutely.
Even though I just look at our topics and they just...
oh, Jesus, really?
In the wake of the... Well, it's just exhausting, actually. But I don't know how much you've been aware of it, but in the wake of the Puerto Rico disaster, and I mean, it is just shocking, the poor conditions these people have to deal with, and our hearts go out to them. In the wake of that, what gets much more news, of course, is Donald Trump, inserting himself into the NFL national anthem protests. Have you been reading about this?
Barely. I just sort of saw one or two headlines. It confuses everyone in Australia, so it doesn't make it to the front page as much, but yes.
Well, I mean, why I even bother bringing this up is that only 38% of Americans side with, apparently, the athletes who are protesting, using the national anthem to protest the plight of African Americans, especially in terms of police brutality and injustice. This is where it began last year with Colin Kaepernick, a man who gives all his time and all his money to promote causes of racial justice, racial equality, and of course, who's always stayed clean, stayed out of trouble with the law, and of course, has been blacklisted from having a job in the NFL as a result. But he somehow got forgotten in all of this. But the president decides, instead of talking about anything presidential or doing anything presidential, he will refer to athletes who protest as sons of bitches and say that they should all be fired. That was his words. So this becomes a big thing where now suddenly he engenders a league-wide protest because, of course, the players are going to have the backs of their own. They all kneel for national anthems. They protest during the national anthem. A lot of Americans, as only Americans can do, decide to ignore entirely what America is supposed to be about and the concept of freedom and freedom of speech and get hostile and say, how dare they, you work for us, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Only 38% support their right for such self-expression. But I would point out that as sad as that is, there are some interesting things about this. First of all, one of the reasons that you're not supposed to do it is because, gosh darn it, troops have fought and killed for your right to do this, so how dare you do the thing that they have fought and killed to protect your right to do. And of course, the veterans, they're the ones that tend to be all right with it. because, again, they fought for your right to do this very thing. They don't take it
as
an attack against them. They take it at their word, which is it's an attack on police brutality. The second group, oddly enough, the majority of whom are in favor of it, surprisingly, or on the side of it, or understand it, are the hardcore football fans.
Right.
The statistics show, very interestingly enough, that 1 in 3 people identified themselves as a hardcore fan, 1 in 3 identified themselves as casual fan, and 1 in 3 identified themselves as no fan whatsoever. The ones who are not fans whatsoever, not surprisingly, they seem not to really have feelings about the national anthem protest one way or another. The ones who identify as casual fans are almost uniformly against it. And the ones who identify themselves as hardcore fans, they're the ones that are actually okay with it, whose enjoyment of the game is not ruined by people actually expressing their humanness and their point of view.
Okay.
So I've said before on this show that the day that we all have to kneel or rise or put our hand on our heart, the day we are all expected to do any of those things is the day that none of us should, right? Because it is about freedom to do this. You're not honoring anything by being forced to do it. But I had a couple of things specifically that I wanted to address. This idea that somehow this is hurting the popularity of football in the wake of the CTE scandal, right?
The
how concussions lead to the brain disease, which leads to the early death of players and to horrible life conditions of those players. 27-year-old Aaron Hernandez, who killed himself while serving in prison for a couple of homicides after an all-pro career. He was taken directly from the field into court and into prison while an all-pro player because of murders. And then it turns out at 27, he has level 3 CTE, they find out in the autopsy after he kills himself. An active player, 27 years old. A level 4 is the worst. So, you know, it is true that while not every player has CTE, every player is going to get it. Every professional player is going to get it.
But why is that just showing up now? Like, why?
That's the thing. So this is the scandal about it. In the wake of the NFL denying it because their lawyers and their lobbyists are the same people that worked for tobacco, big tobacco, for them deny and climate deniers. They buried the science for a long time and they lied about what they knew. And so in the wake of that, and in the wake of how many players get into trouble over things like sexual assaults and domestic violence and then are still allowed to play, in the wake of how the NFL union, players union themselves, has sold out the players, you know, their contracts are not guaranteed. These players play for an average of 2.3 years and they're not even played for guaranteed money. They're not taken care of after their retirements. I mean, it's incredible that it's the richest sports league in the country and the players get the least and have the least power. And yet it's the most popular sports league. I understand if people are saying, well, I've really lost my appetite for following football. But I think if they're honest, the anthem at most is just the cherry on top. It's been a lot of things that have been... also, 38% support is actually a lot of support for civil disobedience. Martin Luther King Jr.'s peaceful marches met with something like 4% approval at the time. And nowadays, they carry 96% approval. It's 4% that disapprove. So the majority is not always right. Of course, democracy has been carried... That idea of majority being right has been carried about as far as it could be through human history. And you know, that number...
Well, and this is the thing, protest... Remember the 68 Olympics?
Of course.
The winners?
Yeah, Bob Beamon and the upraised arm, the fist.
Yeah, yeah. And that was celebrated as a civil rights triumph, as I recall it, in Canada. So I don't understand why now... I guess, like anything, historically, one Once one realizes on what side of history all of this is on, then one gets on the right side of history, as it were.
Exactly. And that takes a while.
Changes.
And that takes a while. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But and what I would love to see, like, I have no problem if you're offended by the people kneeling before the flag, but
right.
And expressing that. But I'm giving you the same right that I'm giving them, you know, protest
yeah.
what offends you. And if their action offends them, you know, protest that. But this idea that, well, you work for us, just stick to sports or just stick to entertainment. Entertain me, monkey boy, is basically
right.
the attitude. You dance, right? This idea, do your job. Well, first of all, it's in none of their contracts that they need to stand for this. In basketball, it is.
Right.
But in football, it is not in any of their contracts that they are supposed to participate in the anthem. So it has nothing to do with their job. Oh. But secondly, how would you feel if there was something abhorrent going on at your workplace and the attitude was, well, don't speak up for that. We pay you. Do your job. Go do it on
right.
your own time. Complain about that thing here on your own time. You know, we're supposed to stand up for what is right and kneel down for what is wrong in this instance. And so I think the subject over, well, is it the appropriate forum, is a conversation that I'd love us to move beyond so that we
yeah.
could get to, is it an effective forum? Because that's a more interesting
right.
question for me. And that's the thing. I don't know if kneeling before the flag until Donald Trump, interestingly enough, engaged himself into this. I don't know if a lot of people even knew what it was about, the kneeling for the flag.
Right.
And I'm not sure what the right place would be, the most effective place would be. But I loved to, when I would meet people this week who were dead set against it, and they would just say, it's inappropriate. I then asked them, well, wait a minute. What if these players were kneeling in protest to how their own league lied about knowing that these concussions lead to the CTAE, brain disease, miserable lives, and miserable deaths? If they were kneeling to protest the cover-up that their own employers perpetrated against them, would you
right.
say that that was an inappropriate protest? And almost all of them were silenced at that point.
Right, because
this is the only place they can do it, before the game when everyone's
right.
looking, because people aren't coming up and interviewing these people after games. It's not like basketball or baseball where you have a smaller team and all the stars are being interviewed and have a chance
right.
every day. This is once a week, 16 games. They're gigantic teams. And honestly, they're all too beat up afterwards to actually even address
yeah.
issues. Yeah. So if it was something directly related, then suddenly the idea of protest no longer was inappropriate. And indeed, they realized it would be uniquely appropriate. So to me, what that means is the question of protest isn't a real one. The protests ought to be allowed. The question is, are they effective?
Well, and of course they are, because now there's a national conversation about it.
And now there is. But so I thought that was interesting, that something that was directly related, they realized that this idea of it being inappropriate no longer held. But this is how bad a situation has gotten in this country, where I'm at a bar the other night, and it's the night that Julia Louis-Dreyfus has announced that she has breast cancer. And
right.
there's a news thing, you know, maybe it's an Entertainment Tonight or something like that, or report on at the bar up on the TV. And I hear these people at the table next to me going, oh, God, another celebrity using their platform for politics. And I went, excuse me, how is she getting political?
Right.
And they said, oh, you know, I've got breast cancer, this and this, and using her platform to do it. I said, well, she has breast cancer. She has it. She's getting out in front of the story. Yeah, but she didn't have to do it the way that she did it. I said the way that she did it, she put a post in 140 characters on Twitter because she knew people would hear about it. And they said, no, she said it on the Emmys. I said, no, first of all, no, she didn't. And they said, well, then why are they showing her at the Emmys? I said, because 2 minutes of a tweet is not an interesting visual for television. So they're showing file footage of her. They're also showing clips of Veep. Did you think those episodes of Veep were about Julia Louis-Dreyfus, the actress coming out of character to announce she had breast cancer? What is the point that you're trying to make? And then they said, well, she did bring up health care. Yes, that she's glad she has it. And, she mentioned unions. Right, that she's glad that she has health care through her union. Oh, I get it. You're not allowed to be thankful for a union because that's political. She's pro-union. Can you imagine that person who's getting benefit out of her union is pro-union? Go back to your own country. We got to make America great again. I left very little of these people when I walked away from this. Because there was nothing inherently political. This is personal experience and a personal expression. Right? And we've got to be at the point where people, no matter what your point of view is, can express their personal experiences. Because that's the only way we're going to get to starting to collect knowledge. Right? Because what she expressed was things she knows. I know I have this, and I know I am fortunate to have this health care through my union.
Right. But now everything is seen in a lens of political binary. What's even worse is, a black and white paintbrush that can no longer see nuance, can no longer see not even politically neutral. I can't even think of the term that renders the idea of management of systems separate from a dogmatic left-right paradigm. You know what I mean?
Well,
all the conversations now.
And it's got to be the personal. It has to be the personal. Being able to make the personal transpersonal and vice versa, taking the transpersonal and making it personal, that has to be what cuts through it. I mean, this idea that, just stick to entertainment. Just stick to your job, George Clooney, whoever. Just stick to your entertainment. And we don't want to hear about your political. But now you're saying you don't want to hear about the personal. Well, the job of creative people is to take the personal and express it in a form that makes it transpersonal. The personal is the job. Yes. It's the fuel of the job.
Right.
So I'll leave it there. I will share with you that Stephen D. Fowler wrote us, and apropos of Julia Louis-Dreyfus, he said, I was remembering your conversation a few episodes ago when talking about Veep, and you were saying it's hard to do such a toxic show without taking on that toxicity, or words to that effect.
Wow. That's a thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is tough. I mean, it for an actor, right? I mean, you're as our friend Lee McCloskey said, the actor is wading in the waters of schizophrenia, because you take on these energies. And
yeah, absolutely. And you fool yourself. You fool your entire system.
Your whole system.
Emotional, physical. Yeah. In order to embody that and embody it, believably. Like anyone goes, well, don't do it so intensely. Well, then it doesn't read.
Yeah.
It just reads as bad acting. So
how do you filter it? How do you release it? That was a really interesting callback. So thank you, Stephen D. Fowler of The Smoke and All-Stars. Another callback that we're thrilled to follow up on is more people in the film business behaving badly. This, again, in the world of film distribution and film journalism. No sooner than we talk about CineFamily and we talk about the Fantastic Fest, which is put on through Alamo Drafthouse, and their rehiring of Devin Faraci 1 month after, he basically admits he raped someone. Harry Knowles, the famous film critic and founder and editor-in-chief of Ain't It Cool News, who
yeah.
worked also with, you guessed it, Alamo Draft House's Tim League and the Fantastic Film Fest. He now has been forced to step down after it's come forward that he has sexually harassed and assaulted dozens of women through the years. I had a conversation about this with someone who said, but isn't he wheelchair bound? You know, isn't he paralyzed? Isn't he wheelchair bound? Which he was for a long time. But yeah, but right. that's the thing. That is one of the big fallacies, right? That a sexual assault has anything to do with sex whatsoever. This is an act of violence that is an act of control. It is inspired by feelings of overwhelming powerlessness. That sexual assault and violence, like any other act of violence, is at its root powerlessness. It's not, I need to get me some. It is the need to usurp control from someone else to make them feel less than, because it will make you think, feel somehow enhanced. And it isn't anything that someone in a wheelchair would not be able to do. And in fact, think about how that might play to his advantage when you hear dozens of people did it. I mean, if he acted inappropriately with you, how do you feel not only that you're going to be reporting someone who's famous, so therefore no one's going to believe you, or you're reporting someone who's important in the Austin film scene or in the film journalism world, so if you have aspirations as a journalist or a filmmaker or a distributor or any of this, you work for these companies, this person already can affect your job, your livelihood. How does that affect your ability to report it? And then, as a human being, how do you feel having to report the guy in the wheelchair?
Right.
So
yeah, exactly.
It's something that he could use to his advantage, actually. I don't think he's wheelchair-bound anymore. From what I understand, his paralysis was caused by diabetes, caused by intense obesity. And and in recent years, like 5 years ago or something like that, maybe less than that, he started to feel his toes again. And so I've seen photos where I think he's standing. And indeed, the belief is he'll be able to walk again at some point. But he may, maybe he'll be walking himself behind bars, which certainly would be appropriate. Akasha's not happy about this.
Akasha's upset. Exactly.
Enraged.
He's growling.
By this. But this comes as no shock to me that in the fanboy world, misogyny runs deep.
Of course, fanboy as a keyword.
Objectification of women, stereotypical roles. There is a lot of this. It runs deep. It has been allowed to be perpetuated and celebrated. And it was only a matter of time before it got exposed. And indeed, at a time when so much, again, say what we will about the global corporatization of so many industries. But one thing that does happen is corporations are terrified of the smell of these kind of things. And so we are at a time when more of this gets to be exposed in a certain way.
Fantastic.
Should we talk about some actual movies before we get to a lightning round of our largest number of celebrity deaths in history?
Yes, let's do that.
First, before we talk movies, speaking of fanboy culture, did you happen to watch any of the new Star Trek show?
No.
Okay, Star Trek Discovery. You have access to it. You have Netflix, right?
Yes. Is it on there?
Excellent. Yes. Internationally, it was released day and date on Netflix. Here, it aired on CBS. Through the first week, they think that the audience was quite a sizable 15 million people. So naturally, they're making everything else available only by subscription through CBS All Access. Their hope is they will have 4 million subscribers by the year 2020. So, according to CBS, it's smart business to take an audience of 15 million and to expand that into 4 million by 2020. Because the vast majority of people who watched it, of course, are people my age and older who can't even figure out how to work the DVR, let alone subscribe to something called CBS All Access. But but the international partnering with Netflix, and ironically, creating these things like CBS All Access is a desire on the part of so many of these networks and content producers to kind of start to regain control from Netflix. But the irony is Netflix is the one that stands to gain the most because they have the international footprint. It's available internationally. And they're the ones that might be helping the brand because Star Trek's never really done well internationally. But since they have something that people can start with that predates the original series, maybe people will fall in love with it and then go, oh, you know what? I would like to watch that Kirk and Spock series, Star Trek, now.
Right.
And, oh, it's available on Netflix. So the fan base, ironically, might be greatly expanded, but only internationally. Here, I believe business-wise, they're killing it off. They're killing the brand off in the name of a business model that makes sense for CBS financially. But what I would love to do is have you watch the show, because I refuse to on the basis of this financial model. And because I think it is anti storytelling. I think it's anti creative. Do I understand it from a financial standpoint? Maybe, but I still think if you've got something that's quality, you want to build it, you want to grow its audience, and you want to find out a way to make money off having all these people like it. So I will continue to review the business side of it, and I would love for you to review the actual show.
Okay, awesome. I see it here on my Netflix queue. Very exciting. Just seems to be released, so I will get on that sucker.
Excellent. All right. Awesome. A few movies here of recent vintage that I wish to discuss with you. One is Peter Landesman's Mark Felt, The Man Who Brought Down the White House. Did we talk about this? I know I made fun of the title, but did we talk about it at all?
I think we did a little bit, but let's hit it again.
It's a fascinating film right now. You know, people are saying, well, but there was already a better Watergate movie. And indeed, it's not a great movie, but Liam Neeson as Mark Felt is fascinating. And let's not kid ourselves. They made this movie right now because of the perilous position the FBI is in right now to maintain its independence and its autonomy within the Department of Justice. So they told a story about the last time the FBI was ordered basically to stop an investigation into the executive branch. So it's an interesting film, and it is one that I think people ought to see, not only for Liam Neeson's performance, but also because of the questions it raises.
Right.
I saw the second Lego movie, the Lego Batman movie, directed by Chris McKay.
Yeah, what'd you think?
Very funny. Will Arnett, hilarious. It's actually one of the better Batman movies, but it also shows that these Lego movies are definitely going to be operating under the law of diminishing returns, because it's exhausting in a way that the Lego movie was not. And you know, it's all about being funny, not being funny right now, not being funny over time.
Too topical.
Yeah, and it's just so clever. It's relentlessly clever. But like I said, it to a degree, it's like what I felt when I saw Team America: World Police. I felt like I was getting my cool puppet movie, and I felt like I was getting an action movie.
Exactly.
And so I felt like I was getting a funny Lego movie, and I felt like I was getting a Batman movie. But again, like I said, the fatigue factor is such that you go, they may want to pull the plug on these Lego movies because it is the law of diminishing returns. And sure enough, this last weekend, Ninjago, the third Lego movie, comes out. It's the first one to get bad reviews and another big cut in the box office take. So,
right. And that's going to start diminishing the Lego brand. Lego has been paying for these things as a way of promoting box sets, all that sort of thing. Once you got one of those movies that suck,
you know Lego's going to be wary as hell of continuing this model.
I saw the what is being called, I realized, a sequel to Mrs. Brown. Remember the wonderful 1997 movie with Judi Dench as Queen Victoria?
Yeah.
I think it was her first nomination for Best Actress. And Billy Connolly
right.
as John Brown. And their very touching romance in Scotland near the Balmoral Estates. So
right.
20 years later, Judi Dench is back playing Queen Victoria in her final days in a movie called Victoria and Abdul, an unknown and untold, mostly true story about a servant from India who comes and who strikes up a very unusual friendship with her and becomes her teacher. And what an interesting story that would make. And I guess they based it in some part upon his unpublished diaries. And what a truly offensive and horrible movie this is, based on the idea of, you know what people love? They love Judi Dench in lightly Indian-flavored movies, like The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. And you know what we'll do to tell our story is we'll make fun of how uppity and how racially insensitive England in the Victoria era was, because they can't understand what you would see in this gorgeous, handsome actor model who comes to serve her, who
really?
Looks nothing at all like the real guy. And it's still so offensive. It's like this movie is the one that's racially insensitive because it doesn't bother to make its Indian protagonist ever a real person. It's just a series of attributes they give him.
Oh, no.
And it wastes, it wastes a performance by Judi Dench. It begins a bit like a farce and you're going, okay, well, maybe that would be cool. This could be cool as a farce. But it just, it wants everything out of every scene that it does. And so there's no real genre this film is in. There's no real narrative thrust to it. It's scene after scene. And Judi Dench, old though she is still a ferocious lioness with a lot of teeth in her head. And she would be game to do whatever movie it was that you wanted to make. So
right.
pick one that's worthy of her. But it's bad news when you're sitting there and you're reminded of other Judi Dench movies, especially when the two of them are Mrs. Brown, which was great, and The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, which was the worst kind of white culture tourism.
Oh, yeah. No, I can't. I agree. I was never going to go see it. But the Marigold Hotel, I was curious about that, but I thought if it was super historically accurate, I would enjoy it, I would think. But you make it sound like it's pastiche.
No. Interesting supporting performance as her son, as the, you know, the heir to the throne by Eddie Izzard. That's some good casting. But
That's funny.
A huge disappointment from Stephen Frears, coming on the heels of Florence Foster Jenkins, which was, again, a big hit for people older than me, but was hugely embarrassing, I thought, as well. It's only been 4 years since Judi Dench and Stephen Frears worked together on Philomena, but it is not to be underestimated, I think, how much Steve Coogan brought to that movie, namely a refusal to let that movie ever become sentimental.
Wow.
Right?
Well, that's tough to do.
And he didn't. And that's why Philomena worked. Because otherwise, I think a lot of times, and clearly Stephen Frears is showing, he's no stranger to let things drip with sentiment.
Right. Which, you know what I saw that was totally, shockingly free from sentimentality syrup? The Stephen King revival of It.
Oh, very nice. Now, I have not seen the finished version of this. I saw a screening of this a long time ago. I found it to be a bit of a mess. I found, as one would expect when it switches directors midway, I thought the kids and all the storylines around the kids was really a huge improvement. But, you know, if you remember Tim Curry as Pennywise, this thing just ain't scary. That's the problem.
And that's the fact. It's not scary per se, but what it's not also is treacle. It's it's like a better E.T. It's like a better version of E.T. where you replace a sort of nutty clown with an alien from outer space. So you have that same heartfelt adventure story.
From the point of view of kids, really understanding the point of view of children. Kids. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I don't know if it was in the original cut, but a lot of the psychological distress and fear that the clown is feeding on is coming from the family relationships that each one of them has. Well, not each one, but, you know, they go through specific things. So it was this kind of neat echo between stressful family life and a clown feeding on fear. So I was actually more impressed than I thought. I thought it was going to be, you know, so many horror movies have disappointed me over the years. And this one held together because it wasn't scary for sure, but it was also effective as a storytelling from a kid's point of view.
It's like I said with Dunkirk in their finest, although, yeah, and kind of like Titanic and Night to Remember, and I wish I could combine them, because what the original did not do well, this did exceptionally well, and what the original did very well, this did not do well. Cape Fear was another one like that. Remember when Scorsese remakes Cape Fear? And and I felt like the Nick Nolte and the family dynamic is so interesting in his remake, so much more so than the Gregory Peck character and family dynamic in the original. But De Niro is nowhere as compelling or scary as Robert Mitchum. So it was, again, the weakness became the strength, but then the strength became the weakness. I did see, you know, apropos of these seeing films from a child's point of view, we spent 2 weeks having fun talking about that list of movies that people should see before they're 14. I found one that I would have on my list. It's a new release coming out this fall called The Florida Project, and it's from Sean Baker, who made the fantastic independent film Tangerine on iPhones. Oh, yeah. He made it on iPhones. Right. He followed transvestites around West Hollywood and kind of showed what their life was like, interweaving some actors with them. Well, he's taken the same approach on a bigger budget to Orlando, Florida, to a stretch off away from the theme parks that caters to people who are going for Orlando vacations, but on a real low budget. And a lot of the people in these hotels are actually residents who have fallen on really, really hard times. And he shows this world by following around primarily one child and her two best friends. And it's from their point of view. And then the male lead, the adult lead, in addition to the little girl's mother, who was a non-actress, was Willem Dafoe, in a great movie star performance, a great character for him to get to play as the manager of the hotel. And it's such a wonderful movie. The storyline of the adults, it's handled so well. For example, Caleb Landry Jones, who starred in Get Out and Twin Peaks The Return, he comes in one scene to help Bobby, Willem Dafoe, an older man, get rid of a mattress in a room that's been infected by bed bugs. And there's no payoff to that scene. You just see them struggling with the mattress and throwing it away, and Caleb Landry Jones complaining, saying, if I'd known it was bed bugs, if you'd told me, I would have brought gloves. I mean, this is kind of unfair. We don't see him again until later when they're moving a broken down ice machine into an elevator and they're struggling with it. And he mentions something, and suddenly you become aware that this is not a fellow employee. This is his son who has come to help him out with this. And Willem Dafoe tries to pay him, and he goes, I don't need the money, and in fact, I can't do this anymore. And it's all you get to know about his family life, but that's all you need to know. You find out, you know, he's estranged from his wife, his grown son. They have no ability to talk to each other except over odd jobs. I thought you could use the extra money. No, Dad, I'm working now. Don't you remember? And no, he doesn't remember. Like, that's all you need to know about that. And it smacks as real, and it smacks as why this guy would be in that job living in the hotel where he works. Less said about it, the better. But I will say this, that afterwards at the Directors Guild Lily and I spoke with our friend and associate producer on The Lady Killers, Eric Mark, and every time I would bring up any moment in the movie, Eric Mark would start to cry. That's how powerful this little girl's performance is in this movie. Again, from her point of view, and I don't want to make you think that it's documentary style. It's very artistically done. You know, whereas Tangerine was much more documentary style. These are some of the most artfully composed frames. How these human beings that have been forgotten maneuver their way through these elaborately constructed, artificial, and often programmatic landscapes. Almost like people are the items of commerce that get bought and sold within these programmatic architectural structures. So it's a fascinating film, and I would have it on my list of movies that everyone should see with their parents or their teachers before they're 14.
Wow. Okay.
All right.
That's a good thing.
Let's tell the networks that we're going overtime, all the affiliates down the line, we're going overtime. We're at 55 minutes right now, and we have the largest collection of celebrity deaths, but if we don't get to it, we're never going to, and we owe it to some of these people. So let's just go a few minutes overtime with something we call celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
The first one is someone that I really didn't know much about until I hung out with you and Bruce and Tom and Lily in Dallas this Memorial Day, right? Weekend.
Right.
Basil Gogos, who mixed realism with hallucinatory colors to create some of the most memorable images of movie monsters ever illustrated, died at 78. In 1960, he began illustrating the covers of famous monsters of film land.
Oh, I didn't know he died.
Yeah, just died. Boy, those covers. I mean, you know, many of the films that he was... It's tough to really appreciate this now, but so many of the films that he was drawing from were black and white movies, and his covers are so colorful.
Yeah.
And what's odd is that they would be so grotesque at times, but always sympathetic and appealing.
Yeah, yeah, the real love for it. I mean, think of that Green Frankenstein that you almost think now is the original image, but it's not. It's actually the famous monsters image, but it's actually as popular as the movie itself.
Basil Gogos, 78. S.I. Newhouse, if any billionaire media mogul can be low profile, it was S.I. Newhouse, who ran the parent company of some of the nation's most prestigious publishing houses like Random House and magazines, died at 89. He was the chairman of Condé Nast since 1975, and as such, bought and remade The New Yorker and Details and Vanity Fair. Other magazines included Vogue, Wired, Glamour, W, GQ, and Self. And before selling Random House, he had spotted a magazine profile about a rising young real estate mogul and was inspired, therefore, to come up with the concept and commission a book called The Art of the Deal about Donald Trump. So he was plagued by cunning foresight, and I wonder if knowing what hell he hath wrought is what caused him to die, and I hope he struggled with that in his final days.
Oh my God.
He was also responsible for bringing in Britain's Anna Wintour and Tina Brown as editors, and look, I don't read a lot of these magazines that I just mentioned, and you know, certainly if you're my age, you've heard of those people. I mean, editors became celebrities under S.I. Newhouse. And I think that that actually is a sign of how low kind of profile he was, because it gave room for the people within their own fiefdom, as opposed to, let's say, in a Rupert Murdoch-esque kind of world where he's the biggest star. They became the big stars beneath him.
Right. That's fascinating.
Bobby the Brain Heenan died, Dean, at age 73. He'd been battling throat cancer since 2002. His career spanned more than four decades. Bobby Heenan was the brain behind some of the most prolific superstars in sports entertainment history. He was largely, right, a wrestling and sports entertainment manager, using his motor mouth and his sarcastic wit on their on his clients' behalf to make them big stars. He also parlayed it into an equally successful commentary career. I mean, he was a fixture on so many entertainment sports programs and was wildly entertaining. I mean, sometimes, you know, even if you didn't like wrestling, sometimes you watched because the interplay, especially on those early days on like USA Network and things like that, were so entertaining. But some of the wrestlers he brought to prominence: the Blackjacks, Big John Studd, King Kong Bundy, Ravishing Rick Rude, Mr. Perfect, and of course Andre the Giant.
Of course, yeah, found all those guys. I wasn't a big wrestling fan myself. But,
anybody
you know,
in your family? In your family ever hang out watching wrestling?
No, not really.
Because I feel like that was that would be a big cold weather climb kind of TV show. Like, I mean, was wrestling never big? I mean, I know Canada's different, so maybe it wasn't. But I feel like certainly...
No,
yeah, go ahead.
No, wrestling was big in Canada.
Okay.
And yes, I was, you know, put in many a wrestling hold in elementary school, ridiculously enough, but not a fan of it. And we could not get past the fakeness of it all. So, and not realizing that's part of the joy.
From wrestling to boxing, Jake LaMotta died at 95, died in Miami after having been admitted for hospice care. Of course, he was the subject whom Robert De Niro played to an Oscar in Raging Bull. LaMotta's career is fascinating. He began fighting when he was a child. He was forced to do so by his father to support the family financially. He'd fight the other neighborhood children, and adult spectators would bet on them.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it.
Yeah, that's rough.
That's rough.
By 19, he had honed his skills enough to go pro. He was an aggressive fighter with a brutal style, as you would expect when you're forced into cockfighting as a four-year-old or whatever it is. He had the nicknames the Bronx Bull and the Raging Bull. Among his early fights was a legendary series against Sugar Ray Robinson, which is really a large part of the focus of Raging Bull. Their first fight was, I think, 42, and LaMotta lost that bout, but won their second when he became the first ever person to defeat Sugar Ray Robinson. Robinson would win four subsequent fights against LaMotta, though never be able to knock him down or put him out. In 1949, LaMotta defeated world middleweight champion Marcel Cerdan in a title bout, and he held that title until 51 when he lost it in his final fight against Robinson. That fight went down in history and was nicknamed the St. Valentine's Day Massacre because took a beating. And he lost when the fight was stopped in the 13th round, and LaMotta would never regain his championship. And he would fight thereafter in another weight category and all of that. Did you ever hear the story that Stephen Bock has in Final Cut about, I probably have shared it on the show, I'm not sure, but about when he went, United Artists made the movie, but they said no originally, and Stephen Bock went to a meeting with Martin Scorsese to tell him why he was saying no. And at the table at Martin Scorsese's apartment was just this shirtless, barefoot, homeless guy at the meeting with Scorsese, like unrecognizable. And he didn't speak, but he was there the whole meeting. And finally, you know, getting frustrated by telling him all these reasons he wasn't going to do it, and Scorsese not taking no for an answer, Stephen Bock finally says, look, we're not going to do it because this guy is a cockroach. And suddenly the barefoot homeless guy speaks up and says he's not a cockroach. And he gets up and he leaves the room. And only then does he realize that's Robert De Niro.
Oh, God.
And 2 weeks later, There's a knock at Stephen Bach's door, and he opens it, and there's a box in front of papers, of loose-leaf papers. And it's a typewritten rewrite of the screenplay. But there's no indication of date or draft number or anything. But it is an entire structural reconfiguration and reimagining of the character. And as Stephen Bach writes, he wouldn't exactly... Well, he just said it was so compelling how this story was told that he had to greenlight it. And all he knows about this rewrite is that the bottom corner of every page in lowercase are the letters RDN. So he went to his grave, Stephen Bach, believing that uncredited Robert De Niro wrote the draft that wins all these awards because he understood the character so completely.
Right.
So he was glad. So Stephen Bach, as he writes in the book, was glad that he greenlit the film, glad that it got the success and the notoriety that it deserved, though he still thinks Jake LaMotta is a cockroach. It's a great story.
You know, it's true. He doesn't come across Raging Bull as that much of a lovable character. There's
no.
All the issues are painted out for sure.
No, and what was interesting was how much he celebrated how much his flaws and warts and all of that were showcased in that movie. It's fascinating. He loved that movie. But, okay, Bernie Casey. This one was sad for me. Bernie Casey, the first African-American actor to play Felix Leiter. When Sean Connery comes back to the role in 1983 for Never Say Never Again, he was a professional football player turned poet, painter, and actor who would act in such films as Revenge of the Nerds and I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka. Died at 78. Now, this guy's story needs to be shared. He was born in West Virginia in 1939. He raised in Columbus, Ohio. He excelled as an athlete in track and field and football and attended Bowling Green State University on an athletic scholarship. He played wide receiver in the NFL for the 49ers and the Los Angeles Rams before then going back to his alma mater and getting a master's degree in fine arts. For him, the arts always came first, and the athletics was a way to get the money for it. He painted, he published books of poetry, and yet football was the association that would always be following him all his life. Even though he told the Washington Post in 77, it was just a gig, meaning football. But it limits the way people perceive me. That can be frustrating. People have tremendous combinations of talents. A man can be a deep sea diver and also make fine china. His art, in particular, captivated many famous minds, including Maya Angelou, who counted it as one of her primary inspirations. She wrote about Bernie Casey's painting, "His art makes my road less rocky, my path less crooked."
Wow.
He always wanted to be a painter, even when he was an athlete. His acting career began with Guns of the Magnificent Seven in 1969, a sequel to The Magnificent Seven. He appeared in 35 films, including Boxcar Bertha, The Man Who Fell to Earth, Brian's Song, and Never Say Never Again. I mentioned Revenge of the Nerds. I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker. On television, his credits include Star Trek Deep Space Nine, had a great guest starring role in that, Murder, She Wrote, and L.A. Law.
Wow. I want to see his artwork now.
But I mean, some of that had to resonate with you, right? I mean, you know, people tell you got to stick to one thing, but it's because people want to identify people as one thing.
Yeah, well, I guess that's it, isn't it? With your moving target.
Well, if you have permission to be many things, then don't I have a responsibility to explore the many things within me?
Good question.
I don't know.
Do you have
I don't know, but I think, why are we offended when people live free? Because we haven't given ourselves permission to live free, but why haven't we given ourselves permission to live free? Because there's a lot of responsibility that comes with living free.
Well, exactly. It's a lot of work.
So All right, moving along. Charles Bradley channeled the struggles of his life into soulful music. Like I said, some of these are not the most famous people, and I would say that we could overlook them, except their stories I find really inspiring. Charles Bradley, right. This soul singer, dies of stomach cancer. He was diagnosed with it in 2016, but he made a recovery while touring before it returned. He dies at 68. He had only been recording music for 6 years. He came on to recording as a soul singer at 62 years of age. But it was the culmination of a dream that began when he was 14 years old when he first saw James Brown at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. His all-too-brief recording career, he released 3 albums, was the subject of a documentary, Soul of America, and performed on TV shows like Netflix's Luke Cage. What I love is that at least for 6 years, people were paying to hear him sing music, and he was making a living doing it. So it may have taken a lifetime to achieve, but at least for a time, he did get to live his dream. It's never too late.
Nah, that's the inspiring story.
Laudir de Oliveira was the percussionist who really made Brazilian percussion safe for American popular music. He died at the age of 77 while performing on stage in Rio.
No.
Yes. Musician Jovi Jovignano was playing with him on stage and talked about how he had just rained on a spectacular solo at the end of Fibra, a composition by Paulo Moura, and it was super applauded. It was his last applause. The last thing he would hear in his life was this incredible ovation. Played with beautiful energy and great tenderness. And then after the applause, we were supposed to start another song, and suddenly we saw that his conga was down. He was bent over, and he just gently slipped away.
That's how you want to go, really.
He was a native of Rio, moved to the United States after working with, among others, Sergio Mendes, came to the U.S. in 68, caught the eye of rock musicians and producers, played on Joe Cocker's debut album. In fact, he's the percussionist in Feeling All Right, Joe Cocker's big hit. He, in 73, was invited to join Chicago on their album Chicago 6, and then the band invited him to become an official member. Now, when they moved into a real pop-oriented sound in 82, they invite him to leave the band. When they get inducted into the Hall of Fame, they don't include him, and yet after that, when they go tour, they invite him to join them for the tour, which they did. In 2016, but going down swinging, doing what he loves, dying, hearing the appreciation after this tender, passionate, solo, going out, doing what you love. That's inspiring.
Good. That's inspiring.
All right, boy, we're so over time, but these are fascinating. Aren't they, Dean Haglund?
They are fascinating. I'm glad you took the time.
Well, we're not done. Norman Dyren Firth. Norman Dyren Firth, Swiss-American mountaineer and filmmaker who organized the successful American expedition in 63 to Mount Everest that put 6 climbers on the summit and inspired generations of Americans, has died. He was 99. He was more than just one thing. He was also an accomplished cameraman and director, and he was the head of the UCLA Film School in the decade of the 1950s. He worked on movies such as 5 Days, 1 Summer, and the Eiger Sanction. He and his team of pioneering climbers were captured in a Life magazine cover story and were honored by President JFK at the White House Garden reception. And they were responsible for birthing mountaineering as a popular sport in the United States. He was born in Germany. His parents were gold medal winning athletes. They left for Australia and then settled in Switzerland in the 1920s. He fought in World War II for America and after emigrating at the outset of the war. And because of his service in World War II, he was granted citizenship for his exploits in the war. Afterward, then he became involved with the UCLA Film School and with the 1952 Swiss Everest Expedition. Okay.
Fantastic.
Anne Jeffries, actress who starred on General Hospital and the classic sitcom Topper, has died at the age of 94. She was born in Goldsboro, North Carolina. As a teenager, won a scholarship to the New York Municipal Opera Company. She sang leads for that company at Carnegie Hall. She worked as a model for the John Robert Powers Agency. She made her movie debut in I Married an Angel in 42 and starred in the popular Dick Tracy movies in the 40s as the detective's girlfriend, Tess Trueheart, before getting her big hit sitcom with her husband, Robert Sterling, Topper. And that series ran for several years in the 50s. She then retired to raise her children, returning to the small screen in the 1980s to play the romantic rival to Jane Wyman's character on the primetime soap opera Falcon Crest. She's probably best remembered today as playing socialite Amanda Barrington on the soap opera General Hospital, although she also played David Hasselhoff's mom on Baywatch.
Nah. Who could forget that role?
She got a star on the Walk of Fame in 1960. Okay, we're in the home stretch. We got, I think, two left. One, I would be remiss if I did not mention fellow pegger. Is that a thing? If you're from Winnipeg, that are you a pegger? All right. Who am I talking about? What famous pegger died at 96?
Monty Hall, sadly, host of Let's Make a Deal.
Creator. Creator of Let's Make a Deal. Also.
Creator, even.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, so he really had that, he really made those degrees in chemistry and zoology that he got at the University of Manitoba pay off.
That's right. That's all you can do with those degrees. So, yes, he's renowned throughout Winnipeg, champion of the Winnipeg cream cheese, talked about that all the time, made that a cultural icon, culinary icon, single-handedly.
So... we say goodbye to Monty Hall, and of course we say goodbye finally to Hugh Hefner, a true icon of the 20th century. I am sort of overwhelmed by the outpouring of heartfelt affections. What a hero this person was to so many men and women. I had a hard time finding why I cared. I'll be honest with you, Dean. But so much has been written about him, and he supposedly was a really nice guy from what I've heard. People I've worked with have worked with him. But let me share a story that people may not know that I believe is fairly accurate. I believe it's true. If I'm wrong, let me know. But he bought the Playboy Mansion in Holmby Hills in 1971. Big place, 29 rooms in the main house alone. Number of incoming phone numbers and phone lines, especially at that time. And that's a key part of this story, to know that it had all those different phone numbers. Because early after, a Playboy boy had found a broken payphone that dialed out for free, and he kept dialing numbers randomly, asking people for help of some sort. This runaway was hungry. He had nowhere to stay. He wanted to go home. He just sat there calling and calling and calling. Hugh Hefner was wandering around the new mansion, a little lost in the mansion himself. It had a lot of rooms he wasn't yet familiar with. As he passed by a door, he heard one of his assistants in charge of phones talking on the phone. It was late, so he thought it was odd that the guy would be taking a call, so he leaned into the room to hear what was going on. The runaway boy had accidentally called the new Playboy Mansion and was asking for help. Hefner's phone person didn't know what to do with the call and was just talking to him, telling him there was nothing that he himself could do. Suddenly, Hefner took the phone from him and talked to the boy for a while and ended up arranging for the boy to get a bus ticket home. In so doing, he realized that there was nothing out there, no phone line, no help for runaways and for kids in crisis. So he took his own money, donated it to the Metro Helpline, which eventually allowed it to become the National Safe Line, the National Runaway Safe Line. And today, the Safe Line answers calls from kids in crisis, from parents, from people with kids in their life who are concerned, et cetera, et cetera. It helps, along with Greyhound, kids get tickets home. if they like, and it helps them come out to their parents. It helps them if they feel suicidal, if they feel violent, if they don't know what's wrong. The number is 1-800-RUNAWAY, and it has become the most recognized safe line number in the world. And it starts there with Hugh Hefner at the Playboy Mansion.
How about that? Didn't he also save the Hollywood sign twice?
Twice.
And he paid for
More importantly, he saves the Hollywood sign.
Well, no, I'm just saying there's a lot of altruistic benefits that guy has done.
Good. And you brought up one and I brought up one, and that's good. And we salute Hugh Hefner and we salute all these celebrity deaths in this, an 80-minute installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood. Hour is in quotes. But next week, special theme show, we talk about our all-time favorite action movies. The week after that, a very special show with some comedy clips from the Hilarium and a very special interview that I'm very excited for people to hear. So this was our last chance to talk about some of these issues in the world, these celebrity deaths, these recent movies. So until next week when we talk about action movies, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Hagland. See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.